Hello. I wanted to welcome everyone on Zachęta podcast. We are here on the occasion of Andrea Fraser exhibition at Zachęta called Art Must Hang. The exhibition presents Andrea's work from actually different periods spanning over 30 years. Together here, there's four of us. First of all, Andrea Fraser, the artist, key artist in institutional critique, as well as a teacher at UCLA at the moment. There is Mikołaj Iwański, a specialist in law, arts, sociology, as well as art economics. And Martyna Miller, an artist, and myself, Antoni Burzyński. The three of us represent Obywatelskie Forum Sztuki Współczesnej. And maybe I can say a few words about that, because that's how we found ourselves together in this situation. So Obywatelskie Forum Sztuki Współczesnej is an organization which gathers, brings together artists as well as art professionals from different parts of the art field to work together on setting up right or good standards of working in the field. And so that's how we found, or that's how we were invited to talk together with Andrea, because many parts of her work are dedicated or are addressing issues that we are addressing on the Polish grounds as the artists and art workers society. So this is the common ground on which we're meeting, and maybe we could start with an opening question that's actually opening, let's say, two directions in our conversation. Which is that in your work you address a lot of issues connected with how the art world works, what are the economical or what are the symbolic mechanisms involved, and since this is present in many of your works, we are very interested whether you differentiate this as an artistic practice or as an activism, if I can call it that way. So do you differentiate between those two elements?
I do, yes. First of all, thank you so much for coming here to speak with me and for what you're doing here in Poland. And I'm super happy to be in Warsaw and to be having this exhibition at Zachęta. So thanks for speaking with
me. We are happy that we can have a conversation with you about it.
So I do make a distinction between institutional critique, what I think of as political art, and activism. I think of those, for me, those are three different categories. And the way that I distinguish that, I mean, I understand activism, which includes cultural activism, to be political activism that's rooted in a collective or a broad-based movement or a collective group, has a collective basis. Mm-hmm. And that may manifest as an artwork in a gallery or museum, but that's not its primary site or mm-hmm. its primary orientation, and it's not primarily defined as an art practice. Mm-hmm. So I make that distinction. And the distinction for me between institutional critique and political art is that I think very often what we think of as political art, or the way that art usually deals with politics, the political object is somewhere over there, mm-hmm. in some other site, in some other set of relationships. Whereas for me, institutional critique, I define it as a form of critically reflexive site specificity, which is a pretty verbose way of defining it. But for me, what's essential to institutional critique is the attempt to engage reflexively with the structures and relations, including structures and relations of domination that we might call political, mm-hmm. in the situation or the context in which one is working, in which one is active. And but for me, that is primarily, well, in one hand, I think Yeah, it's the way that I think about the world. It's the way that I think about myself in the world. It also is largely framed for me as an art practice. And part of that has to do with the ways in which the art field and art institutions, I think, can create a space for that kind of practice, mm-hmm. where many other fields and institutions do not.
I'm asking about it because there's definitely different practices that meet in your work, and there's kind of like a crossing point. And there is an aspect of it where, like you said, the artwork or the field of art is where you can actually do those things. But engaging in institutional critique or in political art is actually pretty risky and courageous endeavor. So I wanted to...
I'm glad you think so.
What I wanted to say is actually to refer to something that was indicated in your conversation with Chris Dercon, where he characterized your work saying that what you're doing in some of your artworks is saying aloud things about the art sphere, the art field, that most people basically only can gossip about silently, you know, in the after parties. Like, so part of your practice is actually being courageous enough to say those critical things.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I think that a lot of artists in the way that we think about political issues and talk about politics in the art world, I mean, as I kind of characterize it, it's somewhere over there. But even if it's not, it's often, I think, divorced from, not in every case, but in many cases, from what we're doing in the field as we participate in it. From, it's like, as a professor, I forbid my students from using the word interest, as in, I'm interested in this. I'm interested in these politics. I'm interested in those politics. Because it's an incredibly euphemized and sort of distanced way of talking about what's, you're interested in politics? What are your stakes in it? What is your emotional investment? What are the material stakes for you? You know, you want to make money, you want to make a life, you want to make a career, mm-hmm. you want to be recognized, you want to be known, you want to be supported, you want to be affirmed. I mean, these are typically what people bring to wanting to be an artist mm-hmm. on some very fundamental level. But when we talk about politics and when we theorize what we do, we don't talk about any of those things, usually. Mm-hmm. Those things get separated off into some realm that is not legitimate to discuss. Mm-hmm. Whereas from my perspective, those are the fundamental things to discuss, because those are the things that drive us or seduce us to participate in the field in the first place and to participate in its institutions in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's where I try to go. It kind of comes down to, well, honesty is the best policy. But, I mean, that's a really sort of superficial way of putting it. But I think I say, even for myself, I mean, I've been working as an artist now for 40 years. The oldest work in the show is from 1984. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely been an ongoing process for me of understanding why I'm doing what I do and what I want from doing what I do, what I want from art, what I want from the field of art, what I want from its institutions. And that also changes over time. So for me, it's important to kind of constantly be asking yourself that question. And not only saying that the problem is other people's relationship to the art field, mm-hmm. as if we're artists are somehow kind of victims of the market, whereas in fact, most artists are absolutely eager to sell their work and ask very few questions mm-hmm. about where it goes. So this is the kind of, it's what I call a kind of bad faith critique or bad faith participation that I think is very common in the art world, where we sort of do what we do, but we speak about what we do as if we're not doing what we do, as if we're doing other things and actually taking up a different position than we're actually taking to what we do.
How do you create your position that allows you to do this risky thing?
Well, there have been different kinds of life circumstances, but for most of my career, I have worked with commercial galleries off and on, and I'm currently working with commercial galleries. There have also been long periods through most of the 90s and actually most of the last decade when I did not work actively with commercial galleries. Or in the last decade, so in the 90s, I was involved in trying to develop a model for artistic practice that I conceptualized in terms of services or service provision as distinct from goods production. So artists are goods producers usually. We produce cultural goods in a studio, and then they circulate in the market and then are sold, and our compensation comes through the sale of those goods. Another model is a service model, where instead of producing goods, we're providing a service and we're paid or compensated in a direct and immediate way for that service. And there are a lot of problems with the services economy. But one distinction there is that it's pretty hard to speculate on a service the way that artistic, you know, and other kinds of cultural goods can be objects of speculation. So that's one of the things that I was trying to resist. So within that context, in the 90s, I was primarily working with institutions and developed a model of compensation through fees as opposed to through sales. And I was also open to a fee from a collector if a collector wanted to commission me to do something. But I wrote up these documents called preliminary prospectuses, which are not in this show, although I often show them still, that describe my artistic services for different kinds of clients, what would be in this, you know, language. And all of them made it clear that you can contract my services, but what my services are is critique.
So you know what you're contracting. Yeah. You're kind of aware of what you're doing.
So I wanted to make that very explicit. And then after doing some research and writing and examining the relationship between the massive wealth concentration that's been taking place in much of the world since 2000, but it's actually been ongoing for longer than that. The relationship between that wealth concentration and the market, which I was researching and writing about around 2010. Then after that, for a period of time, I continued to work with one gallery, Nagel Draxler, in Berlin and Cologne. But specified that I would not sell my work to individual collectors, only to institutions. And that was a bit of a relief for me because I arrived through that at one resolution of my very conflicted feelings about the art market. But, you know, the sort of question is, and also a little bit before I made that decision, I also became a tenured professor at UCLA. So I did have another source of income.
Touched actually on a few subjects that we actually wanted to follow up with. And I don't know, maybe we can start.
Maybe we can continue academic issues.
Okay, let's go there.
Okay.
Also work at academy. And I'd like to ask you about approach in American academies to the market. I mean, does the academy try to socialize young artists to be a regular part of the market, or they can provide any kind of critical approach to this, to the market?
I think it does vary from program art program to art program. In the United States, there are two models. There are art schools, which maybe are the sort of a little bit the equivalent to art academies in a European context, except they're mostly private, nonprofit. Some of them are private for-profit, like the one I went to, which is called School of Visual Arts in New York. And then the other model are art departments within universities, or colleges. And there's also a range between art departments that are in liberal arts colleges and art departments or smaller schools and art departments like mine that are in what are called R1 universities, which are research universities. So the University of California considers my artwork research and compensates me for that research as part of my salary, as if I were a scientist or a social, you know, an historian or doing other kinds of research. So that is an incredibly privileged situation to be in. But even in a lot of public university contexts, getting an art degree is very, very expensive in the United States. And in art schools and in private universities, it's outrageously expensive, frankly. And some of those schools that charge very high tuition, I think implicitly sort of imply that their graduates will sell art and be able to pay off their student loans and be successful on the market. And there are some programs that support that myth, I would say, by creating events that bring collectors and gallerists and curators to the students' studios. In my program, and then there are other programs that reject all of that and that are much more embedded in the university. There are programs that have an orientation that's specifically a social practice orientation, or that is more specifically a kind of academic or theoretical orientation. My program at UCLA is a kind of a mix because it's one department, but then we have different areas. So there's painting and drawing, sculpture, photography, new genres, which is what I was hired to be in, and what's called interdisciplinary studio, which is what I'm in now. And basically, there is a divide between the situation of the painters and everyone else, which corresponds to, you know, the sort of basic statistics about the art market, which I haven't seen the most recent Art Basel UBS art market report. But the last one, I believe, painting, drawings, works on paper, and multiples, most of which are works on paper, constituted about 80% of the art market by value.
Yes.
Video is 0.5%.
This market is very conservative.
Of the art market by value. So it really is very specific in a certain way to medium. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that very many art students really are aware that that's, you know, how it works, because they go to art galleries and they see all kinds of things. They see video, they see photography, they see installation, and they think, oh, it's in an art gallery. They must be selling it, which in fact usually is actually not really the case. Or if they are selling it, they're selling it at a rate and for prices that do not would not constitute a basis of, right, would not constitute an income for an artist.
So if I understand correctly, Mikołaj's question was somehow related to the academy's rather pushing or suggesting artists to engage with the art market more and more and preparing them, or to focus on their own work regardless of the art market. And what you're saying is basically that in the United States reality of art education, you just can't forget about the market because you need to pay off your student loan because it's been so very expensive to even graduate.
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think I don't know. The students that I work with as undergrads, I don't think they have a clue, actually, of what their prospects are for an income. Mm-hmm. Whether it's from the market. Actually, many of them would like to teach. You know, the graduate students, it's a mix because there are some graduate students, you know, some people come to UCLA to work with artists who are not part of the market. Mm-hmm. Some come to UCLA with careers. I've had graduate student with work in, Art Basel, mm-hmm. Basel or Miami or Freeze while they're students. So it really varies. I think at UCLA as a faculty, we're actually, and I'm, I shouldn't be speaking for my colleagues, but some of our students do want us to do more to support their careers and to support their position in the market. And we as faculty actually are pretty reluctant to do that. We don't want to do it. It's like, you're here to learn. You're not here to sell your work. Now, we're a lot cheaper and we have a lot more funding because we're a public university than a lot of other schools. So again, it depends on the context. And I would say that definitely in some of the private art schools and art programs in private universities, there is much more of a kind of a push toward the market.
Okay, thank you. But my second question is about your diagram, because I studied very precisely and I realized that there is probably for me one missing point. I mean, financial stock market. Because
it's up there.
But
it's just outside of the scope.
I put it outside of the rectangle that represents the art market.
You wrote about the crisis, the mortgage crisis in 2010. Mm-hmm. And during this time was something very interesting because the whole economy, the regular economy was low, but the stock market and art market grow very significantly. Mm-hmm. And I started to thought that the drive of the art market is not on the art scene. It's exactly on the financial side, you know? Mm-hmm. That's why I asked about this missing point.
Well, yeah. What do I have in it? Financial markets or financial industry? It's on the diagram, but it's outside of the box that represents the field of art.
Yeah, kind of one of the gravity points.
So it's up. it's in the blue box that represents the market. Within the field of art, it's the art market. But that box, that rectangle, extends out of the rectangle that represents the art market. And where it extends out, you get financial markets, you get the luxury goods sector, you get the lifestyle sector which it doesn't at all represent the sort of economic field, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, it can't be a really comprehensive. But yeah, I mean, there was a bit of a dip in the art market with the subprime crisis, but there was a very quick recovery. And the recovery of the art market and the recovery of the top 0.001% mm-hmm. was much quicker and much steeper recovery than for any other sectors of the economy. And so, I mean, it's absolutely true. That the art market is linked most directly, and there's some economics literature on this that I refer to in some of my essays, that it's not linked to GDP, it's not linked to the general health of the economy. Mm-hmm. It's linked specifically to the wealth of the top 0.001%. The what are called often also ultra high net worth individuals. And so Art Basel, the Art Basel UBS Art Market Report, which comes out every year, and it's prepared by an economist who works in culture. This report has been tracking the number of millionaires and the number of billionaires globally since its inception, because these statistics are important mm-hmm. art market indicators, as you have more millionaires and more billionaires than the assumption is, and the correlation
even
is that the art market goes
art collection.
Up. Well, you know, let's not go there. But what's super interesting? I mean, this isn't your question, but what's very interesting about this moment is that there's been a kind of collapse of the art market in the past year and a half, mm-hmm. that has not corresponded either to a recession mm-hmm. or to any kind of corresponding drop in stock markets globally, where stock markets have continued to go up. And, you know, the economy is global economy, at least the economy in, you know, the sort of art centers has remained strong. Nevertheless, the art market has kind of crashed.
I'm very interested in how the diagram functions, actually, because, of course, there are five fields that you distinguish, more or less. Mm-hmm. Art market is one of them. There is education, institution and exhibition system. Then there is collective practices, community-based practices, and activism. And they all have very conflicting criteria of like being in them, yet they are destined to cooperate in a way. And this would be my question. Do you think that this is like antagonism somehow imprinted in those, or is it more like collaborative power, some sort of homeostasis? So if the art market is weaker, then other parts respond to it, and how?
Mm-hmm. Maybe first of all, we should say that we're talking about a diagram that I created of the field of contemporary art that was published with an essay called The Field of Contemporary Art, a Diagram, that was published in Eflux Notes in October.
It will be also available in the exhibition.
There's an excerpt, a long excerpt, but certain things were taken out, which mm-hmm. I shouldn't have agreed to probably, but it was translated partially into Polish mm-hmm. and will be available in the exhibition. And the diagram itself is in the exhibition as an artwork. So I just wanted to so mm-hmm. the listeners know about that. But yeah, I think this is really an essential point. And when I first started sort of to hypothesize about the art field fragmenting into increasingly autonomous subfields, which was almost maybe about 10 years ago, it was in the context of really wanting them to just fragment completely. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have to have anything to do with the art market, that it wouldn't keep sort of haunting me as a sort of standard of success, that I wouldn't keep being kind of evaluated, you know, on the same field mm-hmm. as, you know, certain kinds of artists who were very successful in the market that I didn't even kind of recognize as being in the same field as I am. So that was what I hoped for. And at that time, it was like, this is my most optimistic scenario, you know, for the future of art. But then as I started to think about this more, you know, I kind of realized, well, but the other subfields, you know, that have developed in many ways, I mean, over a sort of a longer history, but I think a lot of this phenomena really got sort of started and took hold in the 90s mm-hmm. during a period of just massive expansion and globalization, neoliberal globalization, you know, of the art field. That what sort of came into being curatorial studies, curatorial practice wasn't invented. Art PhDs. Yes. came into being, the idea of art research became very, very prevalent. So all of these phenomena, I mean, those things were happening at the same time that the art market was getting financialized, and artworks were becoming financial instruments and instruments of investment. So at the same time that was happening, curators and museum professionals were sort of self-organizing to establish some autonomy for themselves and a discourse about exhibitions and curating in museums was really developing. And at the same time, art theory was becoming more and more prominent and kind of essential, and artists were defining themselves as theorists and researchers, and that academic field was developing. And then at the same time, I mean, a range of activist practices were emerging and becoming more prominent. And then the fifth field is this field of communities, which you can think of in terms of community-based practices, yeah. But not only. It actually can also refer to small artist communities that are local. So the point is, you know, you're asking about a kind of antagonism. So the model which so the diagram locates these subfields within a frame that's marked with a set of coordinates that are pretty directly, for the most part, borrowed from Pierre Bourdieu's analysis of the field of art. But he has two, three different versions of this. And one thing that is super essential to his analysis is that the field of art, or cultural fields broadly, and he included sociology as within the cultural field, so we're not just talking about, you know, artistic culture, that the cultural field is located within what he called the field of power. And what he really focused on was the conflict between the form of social power based in economic capital and forms of social power based in cultural capital and education. Yeah. So I believe that that struggle still actually, that account of the sort of dynamics of power and the dynamics of the art field are still very useful and still very relevant, and that one can still think, he was talking about the 19th century literary field in France, but I'm applying that to contemporary art, and I think it still works. That on sort of at one side, you have the pull of economic capital, and that's the side of the market. On the other side, you have the pull of cultural capital, and that's the side of the academy. And then the vertical coordinates is what he describes as a sort of a hierarchy of power that then is consistent with the hierarchy of power in society as a whole. So there isn't a sort of a, the vertical axis is not really, it's, the conflict there is positional conflict, right? It's not about the type of power, it's about how much power you have. Mm-hmm. It's just about the sort of quantitative distribution of power, not a kind of the qualitative nature of that power. And so that also is the other coordinate. I think I got very far from your initial question.
My question is rather whether it's stable or changing. Is there a threat that, for instance, one part, one subfield will completely disappear or like lose the power at
or
all?
Or the other dominates.
Yeah. Is it intensifying? You know?
Well, I mean, I definitely, it depends on national context. I mean, this is, it's an analytic model. So it would have to be applied and adapted to every context. And one thing that's always very difficult in sort of graphic representations of data or is somehow trying to represent dynamism, to represent dynamics, and to represent change or the possibility of change, and to represent, you know, time. It's very difficult to do because a diagram is static. But yes, I think absolutely the sort of relationships and the balance of power has changed, and I think it's pretty clear to most people who've been in the art world for a while that the market has, there's a lot more power in the market than there used to be, and that in relationship to the market, the power influence of some other participants who perhaps are more academic has diminished, you know, from 50 years ago. But it also doesn't really necessarily make sense to put it that way, because those fields, I think, were much more integrated, actually, 50 years ago. So to talk about the dynamics of the relationships between them is to accept that those are relatively autonomous fields, you know? And yeah, can they separate? I mean, again, you know, originally I was hoping that they would just separate. But then
wasn't that a kind of like a critical attitude? I'm sorry
yeah,
that
I
I'm interrupting.
So. No, please do, because I can get very wordy.
I was just that was my impression, rather maybe than analysis. But when you were talking about the art market subfield, and you even indicated the luxury goods sector, and that was actually like a critical poking or like saying, guys, you could like, you're kind of close to separating from any other valuation than the art market valuation, from the valuation in the other sectors, which should be probably necessary. So is that correct impression?
I mean... Yes, but most people, so if you go to that part of the art world, this is absolutely obvious and clear, mm-hmm. and it's not a critique.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there they don't take it as...
There's another piece in the show called Index 3, mm-hmm. which superimposes something called the Knight Frank Luxury Investment Index onto an art market index mm-hmm. and a wealth concentration index. And that index shows art as one investment among other luxury goods investment. Mm-hmm. Diamonds, jewelry, cars, watches, yachts, and rare whiskeys, which apparently is the very, very best investment you can make. I mean, that line is like way up there. So in a certain sectors of the art world, this is not a critique. Mm-hmm. This is what it is, you know? And so from within the framework, from within the discourse, from within the values, and from within the criteria of that part of the art market, proximity and intersection with the luxury goods sector is not something to be mm-hmm. embarrassed about. Mm-hmm. It's the goal. Right? So this is why, I mean, this is part of the point of the diagram. Mm-hmm. It's just like we have, maybe we, you, whoever is engaging in the looking at the diagram is going to be in some part of the art field where they have their values, mm-hmm. which they probably generalize and universalize mm-hmm. to some extent. Mm-hmm. But those values really only function at this point within that space. And other spaces, they're completely different values and completely different sets of criteria mm-hmm. that are applied to defining what a successful, legitimate, ethical, you know, position is. And, you know, I mean, I think, yes, I could write a second essay that might engage, and I probably should engage more critically with how I would like it to be. But that wasn't the point of this essay. The point of this essay was just to try to describe it.
We are now in the moment that we, after 10 years, over 10 years, we prepared a new agreement for Polish art institutions.
So maybe to make a little introduction to it, like over 10 years ago, OFSWO, which is like a civic forum for visual arts, have created a sort of agreement between the art community and art institutions to set the standard of artist fees that were supposed to be paid to the artists by the institutions. And this was actually a pretty important moment for us. And by the way, when doing this, we were largely looking at other experiences such as WAGE. And now after more than 10 years, we're trying to update it and do it again on a different model that would have different, let's say, values of or ways of thinking about artistic work included.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the idea is to relate closely the labor of artists, the time they spend to prepare for participating in exhibition and related with like a minimum wage in Poland. So we propose that participation in group exhibition should be a half of a minimum monthly wage. Then small preparation of a small show with new or old works, it's about 3 or 4 minimum monthly wages. And then preparing a show for a big institution or a retrospective is 5 or 6 months of work. What do you think about this idea? We spoke about the minimizing the speculative powers of the market thanks to this solution. But of course, again, it applies only to one of the 5 of the subfields. Anyways, thinking about the services you elaborated on earlier on and the fees, what do you think about this solution?
It sounds great. It sounds great. I think the challenge is, you know, for artists is often to sort of track their labor. And it was wage, otherwise known as working artists in the greater economy, was an artist activist group that created a nonprofit organization in the United States. I think it's about 12, it's 15 years old now, I think.
Yes, it was 2008.
They started exactly at the same time
2008?
As our forum.
Oh, really?
2010.
The certificates were being signed exactly in the same moment.
Oh, wow.
As we did in
Poland.
That's
amazing. Yeah. Yeah. And I was mostly kind of an observer of wage. I was on the board for a number of years, but wage maintained a pretty... was very kind of conscious of the role of the board being supportive and not being involved in programs, which was the terrain of the executive director. And I haven't been involved for the last 5 years or so. I think there was a part of the discussions in creating the fee schedule for wage was what would be a living wage. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember thinking about the minimum wage as a sort of a federally mandated or a state mandated minimum so explicitly in the context of that conversation. But the idea of a living wage was a reference.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what does become very complicated about this, you know, for artists is, one, we don't have the opportunity often to work full time making exhibitions. And two, there is the problem of the sort of rationalization of labor time in relationship to compensation that I would be reluctant to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the sort of, some various versions of that were among the kind of objections to aspects of ways it programs from some artists, you know. So, but it's not, you're not creating a situation in which artists would have to sort of track the hours that they put into an exhibition.
Definitely not.
No, it would be estimated.
That avoids that. Mm-hmm. That
it's more about the idea
problem
of relating this to work. Like creating exhibition with working time that we need to spend on it, because in Polish context it's pretty hard to think in these ways. Like as artists, we are not recognized as a occupation group. Not in,
really.
So this is another like struggle that we actively participate in, but that's the idea, like to bring these two together, that art making is work.
Yeah, it's not like only the object that the artist is bringing to the gallery for the exhibition. Yeah. It's basically the whole process of working which is involved into this.
Yeah.
And this probably gives people different understanding of what is being paid for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only for bringing the painting, it's actually for the whole process when the artist is thinking and then executing the work. Mm-hmm. So that's what we wanted to underline in this in this method of calculating this.
And actually separating art market from the art field, you know, so these are...
An interesting thing is actually, as far as I understand, so this is a very important discussion for us, that wage is scalable by institution related to its budget.
Yes, that was an important component.
And this is thing we are totally ignoring at the moment in our proposal. So I was wondering what would be the arguments, if you know them, that were used there.
For scaling up the fee schedule according to institutional
budget.
Yeah, it feels so obvious that I don't know it's sort of relative to the other thing that is in the wage fee schedule is the top salary in every institution. Yeah. So one of the things that we were also considered was equity within the institution. Yeah. And one of the biggest problems with, you know, if you're working with a small arts organization where no one's getting paid, then it's okay if the artist isn't getting paid either. Mm-hmm. But if it's a multi-million-dollar, you know, institution where everyone is getting paid and the director is getting very highly paid, except for the artist, then that is a serious problem.
Mm-hmm. Do you think in this procession of commercialization of the art field, is it how to maintain integrity within it? Is it really about like personal or maybe in relation to the group that you somehow function within? Or this would be my question. How to do it?
I mean, personal integrity is it's relative to one's value system, you know, and goals and sense of ethics. And again, those are very different in different parts of the art field and in different parts of society. And I do think the first step down that road is being clear and being honest with oneself about what those goals are, of what those interests are, about their contradictions, you know? Yeah. And the conflicts among different aspects of goals and values that, you know, one might hold. Because it's in those kind of conflicts and contradictions that there's often, I think, a kind of mental move of sort of taking a side and pretending the other side doesn't have anything to do with you, which is usually not the case. And that's, with the diagram, I think the most important part, one of the most important aspects of the diagram for me are the terms that identify like what each field produces, kind of what each field defines as being important or valuable in art, of what art does or what artists do or what arts produces or what artists produce. And in the market field, it's value. And in the exhibition field, it's experience. And in the academic field, it's knowledge. And in the community-based field, it's community. And in the activist field, it's social change. And sort of when I got to that, it's like, wow, this really helps. It helped me. And one can define value in different ways. I mean, there are more positive ways to define value, even from my perspective. Like, I'll be talking to artists. And who, you know, are artists of color, are artists who have been subject to colonial power, of artists who have been marginalized for a range of reasons. And they want their culture to be valued, you know? Value, then, is a kind of very positive political thing. It's not just financial value. Mm-hmm. And it's not only the market that produces value. But it is a sort of primary arena in a certain way for, you know, value. There are other kinds of value that are produced in the exhibition field. And it's the same with, you know, there was a very critical discourse about the sort of, experience economy, as if we're kind of going to reduce that to theme parks, you know, and the worst kind of tourism. But experience is something that I really value. And what happens in an art context that doesn't happen in other kinds of contexts is you're not just having an experience, but you're actually encouraged to reflect on that experience and what it means and what it represents. And that's really important, you know? And knowledge is important, mm-hmm. and community is important, and social change. But, like, what is it that you want? And I think a lot of young artists that I work with, it's like, well, I'm engaged in this research-based practice, you know, and I'm producing knowledge that I want to result in social change. It's rooted in my community, and it's going to be an installation that I can show in a gallery, you know? And it's like, okay, you can show it in a gallery. You're not going to sell it, you know? I don't know how much social change you're going to be able to affect from that context. Mm-hmm. What kind of knowledge are you producing, actually? Or are you just, you know, trolling for content for your installation? Mm-hmm. So when it's not clear to people what they want to produce, what they want their work to do, which is the primary question I'm always asking my students, what do you want your work to do? Mm-hmm. Not what it's about, mm-hmm. not what it is. What do you want it to do in the world? Mm-hmm. And what do you want it to generate? And so, yeah, I mean, I think what one often gets is a kind of like a mix of all of these things. And where none of them really kind of pan out all that well, ultimately.
Yeah. Following a little bit this personal positions, I wanted to ask you about your enactment method.
Okay.
Because you seem to take many different positions, sometimes within even one performance, 20 minutes length, and you put on or you somehow channel through your body a lot of, you impersonate a lot of positions. And I want to ask you, of course, it's a part of a concept, but how does it feel to take all of these positions, and how does it evolve with time as a part of your personal experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've done a lot of different performances, and since the early 90s, I mean, for a long time, my performances have, most of my performances have been what I call multi-voice performances.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where, and the idea initially was that I didn't just want to perform people. I never thought of them as characters. I thought of them as positions. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to somehow perform the relations among or between these different positions, including my relationship to those positions. And so along those lines, my thinking about performance is that I'm not performing other people, I'm performing a relationship to other people, which I think is just the honest way to think about it psychologically. You know, I'm using the people that I perform in some way, and sometimes I don't use them well, in the sense that I have a critical relationship in a sort of Brechtian tradition, but I'm also always reaching, because I don't think I'm a Brechtian performer ultimately, I am reaching for also a kind of identification, a kind of empathy. And I want to create a tension for the viewer between being pulled into an empathic, identificatory relationship, often with who I'm performing, and the awareness that I can't possibly be those four men, you know, in the case of that performer. And so it's different with, you know, with each one. Certainly the three more recent, they're not that recent, video installations, projection, I perform myself and a psychiatrist, and they're based on transcripts of therapy sessions. So that's pretty intense. And then Men on the Line, I'm performing four men engaged in a consciousness-raising group on radio. And then this meeting is being recorded, where I'm performing seven white women engaged in an anti-racist process group. And I'm one of the seven women. So, I mean, especially the most recent one, this meeting is being recorded. That work was very informed by something called group relations, which I was very involved with for about 15 years. It's also known as the Tavistock method, and it's a way of understanding and also learning about unconscious and emotional forces within groups and organizations. And all of the participants in this meeting is being recorded had experience with group relations. And so one of the theories behind group relations is that whenever you're in a group, there's a kind of an unconscious matrix that forms through the projections that are constantly flying back and forth, and which are not only projections onto someone, but projections into someone, because it's not just projection, it's what's called projective identification, that they're projections one takes in and identifies with. And in some ways, in that process, that becomes what then is called an enactment in another psychoanalytic, you know, framework. It's an enactment not just of a kind of an unconscious fantasy, but a relational realization of a kind of shared unconscious fantasy. Mm-hmm. And one could go as far as to say that social identity, whether you're talking about race or gender or class or even age to some extent, is produced sort of actively in every group through that mechanism of projection and projective identification. So performing other people is like a kind of projective identification. Mm-hmm. You know, that on the one hand, I'm sort of taking them in. I'm taking in, like in a group, I'm taking their projections in. I'm also, they're my own projections that are producing them in my mind and my relationship with them, that I'm also kind of, you know, it's this sort of cycle. It's mm-hmm. this kind of, so with both Men on the Line and this meeting is being recorded, the way that I was thinking about performance is for me directly related to the content. Mm-hmm. In Men on the Line, it was in terms of empathy mm-hmm. and sort of using acting strategies that were rooted in empathy to try to perform men who were struggling to empathize with women. Mm-hmm. So that the way that I was performing, the approach to performance was a kind of itself, a kind of enactment of aspects of what the men were doing. And in this meeting is being recorded, it has to do with the dynamics of projection and how other people, how we use other people to hold parts of ourselves, often parts of ourselves that we don't want to deal with. And that's also a mechanism that's very active in racism.
We actually had this reflection about like fun in your work, because definitely in a lot of those works, like you can see the pleasure of the of the artist doing this. And we were thinking, because some of your work are, on the other hand, like super kind of analytical and cold. And it's a question we want to ask, like, what is there this aspect of pleasure in analytical work and doing the research and then publishing it in a book? Like, how does it give the same kind of fun experience to you as performing?
No.
Okay.
Performing isn't always fun either. I mean, there's a sense of satisfaction mm-hmm. usually, you know, a sense of satisfaction that I've accomplished something. Mm-hmm. I was asked this question in another talk. Anyway, you can edit that out. But I mean, one thing I do enjoy, mm-hmm. I do enjoy people saying, I can't believe she did that. Yeah. This is something that I enjoy, whether it's having sex with a collector on video, whether it's amassing 1,000 pages of election yeah. contribution mm-hmm. records.
Mm-hmm. That's what I mean.
Whether it's memorizing a 90-minute performance mm-hmm. script, like a 10,000 word script, and performing it in one shot. Yeah. Or another recent work of making sculptures of toddlers, which is something that is very hard to explain why I did mm-hmm. it. But still, it was something like, I can't believe she did that. Yeah. For certain people, it was more shocking mm-hmm. than some other things that I do. And I do enjoy that. There's a part of me that,
if I remember correctly, you made the diagram that we were all the time referring to. You made it kind of for your students, or at least you're using it to talk to your students. And I think that's kind of a position that also allows you or invites you to actually speak openly about things when you're a teacher. So there's kind of people who openly, maybe naively, but not critically, they're looking up to you for real world information, mm-hmm. not for like a PR statement or whatever else.
Yeah.
So that's the position, I think, in which you also say things that maybe shouldn't be, or people would be afraid to say out loud because nobody else is going to tell them, the students.
Yeah, they do appreciate that I can sort of tell them about the art world.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there are a lot of artists who have gone out of their way not to learn about the art world.
Mm-hmm.
And I always found it deeply symptomatic. You know, it's different in different national contexts. But in the United States and a lot of Europe, even kind of going back to the 80s, the 90s, when every other French theorist was turning up, like in every PR statement and every art magazine article, except Bourdieu, that will embrace any French theorist except the one who's developed a critical analysis of our own field.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's very symptomatic, it seems to me, of a sort of desire to not know, to not understand. And so there's a kind of component of, you know, what might be unconscious,
mm-hmm.
what might be repressed because it's associated with guilt, shame, and,
mm-hmm.
and anxiety. And there's a component of what's unthought. And it's unthought and unknown and unlearned. I mean, also because of guilt, shame, and anxiety, usually, but also because it's not taught. Like, it's not necessarily considered a legitimate component of art discourse mm-hmm. or of art education. And that's something that I can try to work on as a professor.
Mikoy likes to say that his subject at the academy is the saddest one.
Yes. That's my students wrote in the at the end we have enquete.
Yeah.
The surveys. kind of pools, you know, to put the marks to the professors, and my classes was the saddest in the whole study.
Because you're teaching sociology of art
yes.
and the art market.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
Yeah. I can sympathize. There's a class that I used to teach called The Field of Art.
Mm-hmm.
Where I would sort of talk about art institutions. They would read Bourdieu. I would talk about the art market. And too many students told me afterwards that they didn't want to be artists anymore, that they got so depressed.
Oh, yeah.
So I stopped teaching it because, you know, it's like, I didn't want to have that effect. I couldn't figure out how to teach it in a way that didn't have that impact. But it's disillusioning and demystifying,
exactly.
which is so important, but it's painful.
Taking part in the collaborating with the commercial galleries and dropping out or leaving this sector and then coming back, I don't know, maybe it's worth talking about this for a little.
I went back.
So you have been collaborating with commercial galleries, leaving the space, coming back, and leaving and coming back. So it's been definitely like a very important decisions for you, like both ways. And it's also connected with one of the artworks which is present in the exhibition. So maybe it's worth...
Which artwork are you
thinking about the Untitled?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not directly. I mean, actually, the second time I left, the services actually really is not represented in this exhibition, which maybe is a shame. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's the services project, which mm-hmm. was a kind of like a massive mm-hmm. project that involved a lot of people, which exists as an archive, which I sometimes show. And then my prospectuses and certain works that I produce within that model.
Mm-hmm.
But those aren't in this show.
Yeah.
That was the 90s. And then when I left the gallery again, when I left Friedrich Petzl Gallery, and that was the gallery through which Untitled was arranged,
mm-hmm.
that was really in the context of writing Le 1% C'est Moi,
mm-hmm.
which is in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And just really being just horrified and disgusted by the extent of wealth concentration and the intimate connection between the art market and that phenomena, especially in the aftermath of the subprime crisis, and how many art patrons were benefiting from a situation that impoverished millions and millions of people globally, and that there was just no critical reflection on that in the art field. And so, and then when I wrote that, it's like, I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I had sort of been, I had been stepping back. I mean, after Untitled, I did step back some, but I was still, you know, I was still working with Petzl. And I mean, after that, I did do two shows with Nagel Droxler in Berlin, where I showed Projection and Men on the Line, mm-hmm. but that was within the framework of saying you can only sell these to institutions. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and then a couple years ago, after COVID, sort of after the COVID lockdowns, I decided to reach out to Marion Goodman Gallery about joining that gallery, and they said yes. Which I consider an honor, because a lot of my, some of my artistic heroes have been associated with that gallery. And I mean, partly it had to do, I mean, it has to do with social aging, actually, mm-hmm. more than anything else, mm-hmm. if I'm going to be
honest. That's
it has to do with a sense of that my concerns at that moment, I felt this way, and I still sort of feel this way. We're not really very politically relevant, at least in the U.S. context. And where, I mean, through a period of from 2015, maybe it started, there was a shift, I think, in art discourse and the understanding of the political in the U.S., and a turn against critique as a political model, and a turn toward different forms of affirmation and care. And some of that was coming out of a kind of queer feminist politics, disability politics, and also Black politics. And so that was something that I was grappling with. And so that kind of, I started to feel more and more like, okay, I'm an historical figure now. So I got this stuff mm-hmm. that I've made over the last 40 years. What's going to happen to it? Mm-hmm. I don't want to like have to just deal with this on my own for the next, mm-hmm. you know, the remainder. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm almost 60, and I'm actually was planning to retire from UCLA this coming year, but I don't think I will, because I've been there for 20 years, and that's like... So there was a sort of a sense of entering, a sort of starting a new chapter in a way. Yeah. And then there was, you know, what I've talked about in, you know, it's complex, yeah, they're personal, you know, of what one leaves behind, you know, as an artist.
And I assume that the gallery representation simply enables or fosters this process of organizing your kind of artistic heritage into the system. So do I understand correctly what you just said?
Yeah, there's a kind of support. I mean, it depends on the gallery mm-hmm. because different galleries provide very different things, you know. And, you know, Christian Nagel, and that gallery is now Nagel Droxler. I had my first exhibition in a commercial gallery with Christian Nagel Gallery in Cologne in 1990. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that's, it's a long-term relationship. Mm-hmm. And now Nagel Droxler, so his partner Saskia Droxler has also become part of the gallery. And there's a kind of support, you know, that they provide. And there's, I think, a kind of loyalty that we mm-hmm. have to each other. And, you know, Marion Goodman Gallery is a gallery, I think it has a reputation that's well-deserved, of really taking good care of their artists and of, you know, sort of standing with artists who are conceptual artists, who are moving image artists, mm-hmm. whose work is not easy to sell, mm-hmm. and making that commitment. And so that's, I think, fairly unusual at this point mm-hmm. for a mid-sized gallery or a larger mm-hmm. than mid-sized gallery. I mean, they just expanded a lot. Mm-hmm. So I do feel very, very fortunate to be able to have, you know, access to that resource. Mm-hmm.
As Obywatelskie Forum Sztuki Współczesnej, we are addressing the issue of retirements for artists. It's an important issue, especially in the 90s, in this period that you mentioned. We had a very special time in Poland because it was transition from communist time, socialist time to capitalism. And this was also a period of very vivid art life, also beginning of 2000s. We called it like a critical art. And so many artists from this period of time are now getting at the age of retirement. However, their social rights are not supported in any way. That's a big issue.
Yeah. So the way the payment system and the circulation was organized results in them not really having any retirement pension.
Yeah.
So
no.
They would not get any of
that. Wow.
And now, like, there's kind of big debate, or at least in the art sphere, like, what can we do about it? Because those people who's been seriously like classical for ourselves, like classic artists, will end up not having really any financial means in the second part of their life. And how can we frame the question now?
Like, yeah, it's hard because we live in a little bit different environments, different systems.
I only knew one artist ever who talked about retiring. It was Alan McCollum, who was really important to me. May I help you? It started out as a collaboration with him. And he was also one of the few artists that I knew from a really working class background. And he was the only artist who talked mm-hmm. about retirement. It's like, artists don't retire, you know?
But that is true.
But we still grow old. Mm-hmm. We still grow old and we still have reduced activity usually, we're incredibly fortunate. And so, yes, it's a very important issue.
The thing is also that maybe it's different in the Western part of the world, but the way it looks in Poland is also that even the artist who's made quite a substantial career or influence into our art history, it doesn't or didn't up to like now, but it didn't go together with the financial gratification in an obvious way. So there's people who we like basically all generally agree that they've done very important things, but it doesn't translate to them being secured even, you know, in the later part of their life.
Well, that's true. It's part of my model and my diagram. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of the pieces of evidence of this fragmentation. That there are a lot of artists who are regularly taught and written about mm-hmm. who don't sell anything, who have no market. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of artists who sell a lot and nobody talks about them, nobody teaches them.
Yes.
So there really is this split. And in a way, it's almost a kind of classical model, but it does take a different form now.
If quotation in art handbooks translated to finances, man, that would probably be the kind of...
If I didn't have this professorship at UCLA, I don't know where I would be financially. I mean, I was in debt mm-hmm. when I got this job. Mm-hmm. I had no savings and I was in debt. I had debt. I did have an apartment.
So that the risky part of actually doing the kind of art you do, which gets super influential, but in the end, you're still in debt.
Well, but I got a job. I got, and I think that's, I mean, but that's also part of part of the model. So with my diagram, sometimes if I want to be really crass and provocative with my students, I'll say, well, if you want to be successful in the art market, you have to make things that someone's really going to want to buy. If you want to be successful, you know, in the exhibition field, you have to make things that people want to experience, or they think other people want to experience, or they want other people to experience. If you want to be successful in the academic field, you have to make or do things that people want to write about and think about, you know, and in the sort of community field that people, and activism it's sort of more similar, that people want to join. Like, these are the sort of fundamental consequences of those criteria. And I think if you're an artist that's committed to making things that people want to think about and talk about, I think you have a, you're pretty well positioned to get an academic position and be supported within those institutions. And if you're an artist who's really effective at making things that people want to experience, there is a very extensive network of exhibitions and institutions that are constantly looking for spectacle and other forms of content and will have budgets and fees to support that. There is an economy for that. I think, again, I mean, part of the problem with the field and where young artists end up is that's not clear, you know? And they end up with this kind of like mix that doesn't really work in any field except this sort of corner where the exhibition field, the community-based field, and the academic field overlap. And that's sort of where it stops, you know? And that can also be, though, a kind of conscious form of resistance, which I absolutely support. If it's a conscious form of resistance to capitulating to the criteria of those fields.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank
and we've touched on some subjects, and thank you for the comments which add up or comment the works that we're going to see in the exhibition. So we're looking forward for ourselves and all of the other listeners to actually see the show and see how those things develop in the actual artworks.
And of course, the conversation continues because there will be a lot of opportunities during the exhibition to meet and discuss different issues until June this year.
And we'll be maybe talking also on Saturday.
Yes. We are.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed the questions, and I really appreciated the thought that and the thought that went into them, and the sort of background research into my work that went into them. And I also really appreciate the work that you're doing on behalf of artists here in Poland.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.